My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border, coast to coast, and all the ships at sea. Streaming live from the County of Kings, Brooklyn, New York City, on the Heritage Radio Network. Are you ready for the fastest half hour on the internet today? It's the Mike and Judy Show, spanning the globe for high-minded hijinks and lowbrow kicks to bring you the best in sex, drugs, rock and roll, and nuclear fission. They're too bad for radio and too good-looking for television. And now, here they are, the Nichols and May of the Now Generation, your hosts, Mike Edison and Judy McGuire.
Welcome to the Mike and Judy Show with my substitute, Mike.
Hello.
Michael Gonzalez. Who's what? He's taking Mike Edison's place, who's draining Italy of its wine reserves.
Oh, is that what he's doing?
He's in Turkey right now. He felt the tear gas last night.
Oh, lucky him.
Yeah, lucky bastard. But Michael Gonzalez is a journalist, an essayist. Hopefully soon he'll write his memoir.
And a short story writer,
and really modest and great.
A genius, almost.
Almost. And we have three delightful guests with us today. We have Chris Flash of The Shadow, which is...
It could be described as the underground, anarchistic, investigative journalist newspaper.
I don't know if celebrating is the right word, but commemorating the 25-year anniversary of the Tompkins Square riot, which spurred you into starting The Shadow.
Right, as a result of the distorted mainstream moron media coverage of the riot.
I don't know what you're talking about. Those people totally deserved it.
Oh, God. Well, it started out, they were very sympathetic to us at first, and that we had been victimized by the police, by these pigs. And as the days went on, the editorial tone of the article started shifting, accusing us of provoking these poor police from all over the outer boroughs into descending upon Tompkins Square Park and beating the crap out of anybody that moved.
Well, because much like Trayvon Martin, you guys were heavily armed, right?
Yeah. we had a helicopter and
and automatic weaponry.
Sure.
Tanks.
And you're here with Sheila Jameson, who is the publicist for the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space. And you guys are doing a film festival.
Yes, it's going to be August 3rd through the 10th. And the first two nights are going to be dedicated to the Tompkins Square riots. We have some films that Chris is supplying that have some authentic footage from the activities in the park those days.
Because what a lot of people may not realize who were probably born in 1988, the East Village used to be a place for normal and, you know, average,
well,
middle-class, poor people.
The East Village had been abandoned by the city because the resources were so depleted in the 70s. Remember the drop-dead New York? There was no sanitation. There was no garbage pickup. There was no water supply. There was no police. And a lot of the landlords also abandoned the area. So people just, you know, reclaimed, you know, a lot of the buildings, a lot of the empty lots, and built gardens and built squats, provided their own services. And, you know, now it's, you know, luxury land.
Now it's like million-dollar condos on Avenue D.
Right.
And our third guest here is also an old-time New Yorker, Michael Holman.
Hey, what's up?
Michael did a pivotal graffiti rock TV show that was in New York, and he's running a Kickstarter to do a documentary about the show.
Yeah, check out Kickstarter, type in graffiti rock, and you'll see what time it is.
Because it was very fun back then. I mean, it was a fun time in New York, and... What's happened to like the fun, the music, staying out so far?
It was like fun danger. It was like a thin line between fun and dangerous.
But if you could get home without getting your ass kicked, it was, you know, like...
Yeah, I think if you're in your 20s, right, you're kind of fearless. Like it could be burnt
out. Yeah, because you can't
die. Burnt out buildings, burnt out neighborhoods, drug dealers, all kinds of dangers and shit. But it's kind of like being on a movie set, like maybe London after the Blitz. You just kind of like just check out abandoned buildings, you're checking out the neighborhood. You're not really afraid. In fact, it's extremely affordable. You have other friends your age, and you're making your own culture, art, music. anarchy, political activism, and you're having a great fucking time.
And you know something, for people who are not native New Yorkers, or for people who are native New Yorkers, you know, there's a objectivity I had when I first came to New York in 1978 that I don't know that you guys even can see so much. When you come to New York for the first time, especially at that period, New York comes off as like a theme park for really intelligent people. I mean, it's like, it's an amazing experience.
Well, you find each other.
Still exists.
Yes, it's still there, but it's still there. It's not what it was. But like-minded people do gravitate toward each other, and New York was a good incubator for countercultural scenes,
yeah,
artistic
all kinds
endeavors.
Of things,
well,
really.
I tell you, I grew up in New York. And I grew up in Harlem, but I didn't discover the Lower East Side until I was like 19, 20 years old.
And that was a good time,
and,
right?
And it was like the early 80s. I think it was like 83. And I wandered down. One of my friends invited me to his house. I think he lived on like 8th Street and Avenue B. I didn't even know Avenue B existed. And then, all of a sudden I'm meeting all these artists and painters and writers and everybody, filmmakers, people that that wanted to do what I wanted to do, people that, you know, we had similar influences, and I'm just meeting all these people, and it was just love at first sight.
I think the neighborhood was so undesirable back then because, as Sheila pointed out, the city pretty much just abandoned the area. And on top of that, you had redlining, which was the bank's practice of not making loans to small building owners and insurance companies not insuring certain buildings in certain areas. And the city raising taxes, white flight to the suburbs, so the tax base shrunk. The feds refused to help the city. Gerald Ford to New York City dropped dead in 1976. He had a number of facts, and of course, a wave of heroin coming into the city. So it made the Lower East Side really just untouchable for investors. Landlords left, the city took over buildings. So you had this scene where people could actually live affordably, maybe a little dangerously, but it was a special time where, like, I don't want to be nostalgic about how bad things were because it wasn't. But I mean, out of all those bad things comes a scene, and because of low rent, because of low cost of living, it's affordable to actually have a scene. I think the powers that be caught on to that, and people I've talked to from the 60s who had their scene going on also mentioned the low rent, the low cost of living. Apartments are like maybe less than $20 a month for a full apartment. They could do music, art, underground newspapers, revolutionary planning and shit,
and be a waitress like two nights a week and afford to live.
But, yeah, exactly. But or do what I did. I helped move this guy with his moving company. I worked one or two nights a week, and the rest of the time, I had to myself, and I had enough money to survive. And I could start a band like I did with Basquiat, and I could make paintings and make films and do all these things. And the thing that's really important to understand about New York at that time is. God, I forgot what I was going to say. I had too much to drink.
You had half a beer, lightweight.
That's
a lot.
But yeah, I mean, okay, so we all moved, you know, people who didn't grow up here, me and Michael Holman, I believe, are the only ones. I always wanted to come here. I mean, I grew up in upstate New York and New Jersey, and it was like this goal to live in New York. And I moved here. I made like $17,000 a year at High Times, which was crap pay even back then in 1988. But we could do stuff like that. We could, you know, okay, I had a hot dog for dinner every night, and I wore those little Chinese flats from Chinatown that were $4.
I remember that.
And like, now a kid growing up in the Midwest, like, what the hell is he going to do when he's the weirdo in town?
You can't start in the city like you could in the past. There were SRO hotels. Let's say you came from some other city, and your first place was maybe an SRO hotel. You could pay $60 a week to live here, to just start. Get a job, save a little money, get a better job, get a nicer apartment, start moving up. You can't come into the city from outside of the city as you could in the 80s, even up to the 90s. I mean,
which, by the way, kind of speaks to what I was going to say.
You got your train of thought back?
my brain cells have been put back together again. It's old age too. But at the time, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, and even generations before that, New York had always been a mecca for people who felt like marginalized wherever they lived.
Right.
They were
right.
The outsiders, the weirdos, the artists, the gay kids, the people that were picked on basically in high school knew instinctively that New York was a welcoming place. So we all came here after, and it's tradition, you know, we came here after generation after generation built scenes. You know, New York, it is dependent on a lot of outsiders coming from around the country as well as from around the world. And today, and we built a scene that drew people from around the world, you know, made people want to come here. And the irony, of course, is that today, the people that are coming here are all the people that we were running away from.
Yeah.
That's very true, unfortunately. It's the old ironic, horrible catch-22. I mean, take the Lower East Side, where it's undesirable now. It's totally crime-ridden, heroin, drugs, crime. City withdrawing services, withholding services. So some people find that cool. They can afford to live here and make a scene. The scene attracts outsiders or transients with money. And they say, wow, this is really cool. Then they want to start buying into New York City. Then real estate and value start increasing. The very thing that attracts the people with money is pushed out by the people coming into the city with their money.
Right.
So
right.
It's a hard, and it happened in the West Village. It's happening here in Brooklyn, too.
Well, it happens in other cities, too.
Of course.
I also want to say, like, During the 80s as well, with all the stuff that was going on the Lower East Side with bands and art and everything else, there was also scenes that were going on in other parts of New York City, especially in the Bronx. Rap music was coming out, hip hop culture was coming out, breakdancing, rappers, DJs. You know, this was another culture
that
was graffiti that was coming out of, you know, these so-called slum areas. You know, the South Bronx was another area that basically kind of got ignored, abandoned during the after the riots, white flight, during construction, and you know all the stuff that Moses
Robert
did.
Robert Moses,
the king of the BX, you know, and all of these different scenes as well was developing it, you know, and at some point they also came together, which was one of the reasons why I wanted to have Michael here, because Michael was part of, you know, bringing some of those scenes kind of clashing
downtown
together and mixing together and mixing them all up into, you know, this kind of cool gumbo.
Well, I mean, you know, I shout outs to Henry Chalfant, Marty Cooper, Fab Five Freddy, Charlie Ahern, myself. We were some of the kids hanging out on the downtown scene, on the art scene, mm-hmm. who recognized that there was something going on uptown, wanted to bring that culture downtown, because let's face it, none of the downtown kids, none of the local media or international media that is based in New York wanted to venture into the Bronx.
It's scary there.
It's scary there. So we were able to bring it downtown and give it a platform for the rest of the world. And I can tell you something, that hip-hop, as we all know it today, wouldn't exist, at least the way it does now, if it wasn't for the downtown scene bringing this new scene and this new other hidden culture downtown and giving it like a platform and a voice.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like that sort of did help hip-hop get mainstream acceptance. Like, you know, Debbie Harry rapping about Fab Five Freddy, even though that was kind of a bad rap, but
yeah.
Are you involved with Downtown 81 by chance? In either the making of?
I'm in Downtown 81.
In
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Where can I say? One of my favorite.
That's going to be aired in the Morris Film Fest.
That's one of the films in the Morris Film Festival.
Stars Jean-Michel Basquiat.
Yeah, yeah. It's really cool to try to identify certain spots where he's going by, and there's all rubble-strewn blocks. And
in the East Village.
Fun to kind of go back and say, look for an identifying feature in the film, and then run to the block and try to find exactly what it is.
Yeah, check out Downtown 81. I mean, it's a fascinating film by Glenn O'Brien, Ato, and Mary Paul.
1981, from 32 years ago.
You see the landscape, it's almost something out of a science fiction movie.
After World War II, London after World War II.
It's all built up now. It's amazing.
It's ugly.
But speaking of Jean-Michel Basquiat, we're going to hear a song from your band, Gray.
Oh, you know them. My friend Nick Taylor.
Huh?
You know my friend Nick Taylor then.
Oh, you know Nick Taylor. Yeah.
Worlds are colliding.
We used to write messages together. I know,
Nick
right?
Oh, that's wild.
Listen, this is the nature of the Lower East Side, you see. Everyone
Shout
is
out to
connected.
Nick Taylor, High Priest, man.
Right
DJ
on.
High Priest. He was the original member of the band as well. And now Gray still exists. We just did a show out in the Hamptons at the
at
Parish
the Hamptons.
Museum. We did a show at the New Museum a couple of years ago. We did a show in D.C. We're going to be doing more shows here in New York Live. And at the point is that Gray still lives. It's myself, Michael Holman, and High Priest Nick Taylor.
So what are we going to hear?
Wow.
We're going to hear a track called Drum Mode, which was actually made for Downtown 81. And it features myself, Nicholas Taylor, Jean-Michel Basquiat, and Wayne Clifford.
All right, thanks. Joe,
How
take
cool.
it away.
Wow. I like that. But that's the nature of the name. Thank you.
And we're back. Everyone's chowing down on good Roberta's pizza. Hey, so Michael Holman, how did you meet Jean-Michel?
Oh, that's a wild, wild story. Quickly, a good friend of mine, Stan Peskett, English artist, Royal College of Art, knew me through the Tubes. Before I came to New York, I was in this band called the Tubes, White Punks on Dope. Maybe some of you guys know about
that.
Don't
touch me there.
Yeah, we played at the Bottom Line in 1975. Anyway, I was in that band, which was like my cutting my teeth in performance art and whatnot.
And in sequin hot pants, I believe.
Yeah. Did you see that picture?
Yes, I did.
I was a ludette. Anyway, so when I first came to New York, I'm a credit analyst at Chemical Bank. I'm a Wall Street banker, if you can believe that. And my boy, Stan Peskett, English artist, we're hanging out on the weekend smoking herb, blah, blah, blah. And one day I'm looking in The Voice and I see a little notice about the Fab Five. It's a graffiti group and it's represented by Fred Brathwaite. And it basically says, if you want your loft or place of business tagged up with graffiti burners, we're the ones for you. You can pay for it. So they were way ahead of the curve in terms of like putting graffiti in a commercial setting. This is like 1979. So I call him up, invite him over. Now it's Stan, myself, and Freddie hanging out smoking joints, talking about crazy ideas. This is all like about January 79. We decide we're going to put together a party called Canal Zone Party, because the place was right on Canal, block away from Hudson, the Henry Hudson, whatever, you know, the Hudson River. And we throw this party, and the whole idea of the party is to bring together these hip-hop artists of the Fab Five, like Lee Kiones, Slave, Mono, all these guys who were part of the Fab Five, and then Freddie, of course, he was an artist, but not really like them. He was more of their spokesperson, like a cheerleader,
a hype man,
exactly.
Hip hop lingo, I know.
And so we're hanging out. We decide to throw this party. So the Fab Five do these giant burners on giant pieces of plastic, and we're bringing the whole downtown scene to introduce these uptown artists, right? And so Jean hears about this. How he heard about it, I don't know. He's probably like 18 or 19 at the time. He shows up like, I want to be down too. So we set up this big piece of photo paper, and he does one of his Samo pieces. And it's like, oh my God, that's Samo. He does, which of the following are omnipresent? A, Lee Harvey Oswald. B, Coca-Cola logo. C, General Mallory. D, Samo copyright. And so he's doing this tag, and I'm interviewing him afterwards. And I kind of like did this stupid interview where I'd ask questions, and then before he could answer, I'd pull the microphone away and ask another. It was stupid.
And you were excited.
I was excited. I was this kid from California. I didn't know what was cool. Afterwards, I went up to apologize to him, and he said, "That's cool, man. You want to start a band?" And I said, "Sure." So we started Gray that night.
Wow.
We started Gray that night. It was April 29th, 1979. But what was also fascinating and really special about that Canal Zone party is that this is the first step and the first moment of bringing the uptown Bronx culture, you know, specifically graffiti in this respect, downtown, to introduce them to the downtown art scene and let that happen. April 29th, 1979. It's also the first day of the creation of Gray. So it was like a really seminal moment.
Did you know how super talented he was at the time? Or did you, I mean, I know you respect all these guys, but did you ever imagine his career would blow up like that?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Jean-Michel Basquiat, the best way to describe him, even the first time you meet him, you knew it. As a matter of fact, when I was goofing on him with the microphone and interviewing him, he did something that a lot of FOBs, friends of Basquiat, say that, yeah, that happened to me too. When he realized that I wasn't going to let him really like answer the question, because Jean was like so focused on his career and becoming blowing up, he was like, oh, somebody's going to be on video? Okay, I want to be on video. When he realized that I wasn't really going to let him answer any questions, his face drained of all emotion, judgment, reflection, and he became a mirror, and I was looking at myself being the fool, and it was like, whoa, like right away I realized I was dealing with a realized being. I was dealing with a superior human, and everybody that knew him will tell you the same thing. Like him or not, he could be a real bastard. like him or not, you realized you were dealing with something, a human design that was like a few stages ahead. Trust me. He was like a Dalai Lama of art. He was a realized being. And everything about him, everything about his body language, the way he spoke or didn't speak, the way he moved, the way he dressed, the way he comported himself, told you that you were dealing with something other than what you... I've met a lot of famous people in my life. I've met a lot of important people in my life, and I've never met anybody like Basquiat.
Oh. Wow.
That's a great story. I mean, and you wrote the movie, like, Julian Schnabel's movie. How did you feel about that, the way it came out?
Well, you know...
I should note that Michael Holman's face has just drained.
My face just drained now. Well, you know, I mean, you know, writers are the niggers of Hollywood. You know, I mean, everybody will tell you that. But, and every writer says that, you know, they butchered my work, da 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 da.
But that's different. This is butchering someone's life.
But in this case, you know, I'd love to read for your audience over the next 3 hours my screenplay, the way I wrote it without it being changed and stepped on by Schnabel and other writers. I don't think Schnabel really understood who Jean was, and he had this opportunity to make a film about somebody who was really above and beyond. I mean, first of all, I thank Schnabel for making the film, because without that film, Basquiat's market would not be what it is today. I believe that the film did that.
I mean, the rumor is that Schnabel was also completely jealous of Basquiat.
Well, that's what it would look like. I don't know what was in Schnabel's mind, but based on the way that my script was altered, the way that the film looks now, the way that Jean's character had been emasculated in the film. I mean, Jean, how can someone be that powerful and that successful and be so wimpy the way Jeffrey Wright had been directed? It's impossible. The math, it doesn't add up. Jean was like the Human Torch. When you met him on the street, you felt like you were like talking to, like, you know, 8 presidents in one person.
Wow.
You know, you weren't talking to some like kind of wimpy guy who didn't really know what he wanted to do and who was kind of finding himself. Jean was like the Human Torch. So the way that he's characterized in that film is just such a distortion of fact in history.
Well, so what is this movie that's playing at the Morris Festival with Basquiat in it? That's
Downtown 81.
Downtown 81.
Which Sheila and I saw together when it was first released, I guess, like, what, 10 years ago now?
It was like 92.
Whenever it was released. No, it was later than that.
96,
it was later,
I think.
96, but well, we saw that on Canal Street. And she and I were the only two people in the audience. It was like the first or second. But, you know, we grew up with that. I mean, I didn't know Jean Michel personally, but he had influenced my life so much. And I remember when I was younger, I had gone to a party at his house when he had done the Mary Boone show. And then Sheila... Well, I think years ago she used to have an original, but that's another story.
Oh, no. Now you can have a townhouse in the West Village.
I had the invitation to his 30th birthday party, which was his final birthday party. That was at Area. And my ex-boyfriend made a collage on top of it. Well, Jean-Michel was still alive. He thought it would be a nice, you know, parting gift.
I hope that ex-boyfriend is dead now.
He almost died. He almost died.
But evil kept him.
So we've got 3 minutes. Let's catch up with Chris and figure out where we can find all of you guys. Chris,
well,
I think you're going to start publishing The Shadow again.
Couple things. The Shadow came out as an anarchist underground newspaper, as an answer to the New York Compost and the Daily Snooze, all their crappy shit.
I don't know what you're talking about.
these crappy shit newspapers that pose as the papers of the working class in New York City, and of course they're anything but. They're owned by billionaires, so they promote a billionaire's agenda, New York Times, Daily News, and the New York Compost. So we came out as an antidote to those newspapers from 89 to 90 to 2008. So for the 5 years, we have not been publishing, but we're going to start publishing this year, hopefully by the time of the 25th anniversary of the Tompkins Square riots. Excuse me. So July 28th, August 3rd, and August 4th, we're going to have 3 shows in Tompkins Square Park to commemorate the 25th anniversary of the August 6th, 1988 police riots in the park.
Who's playing?
I have a little. I just happen to have a list of bands. Well, thank you for asking, Judy. I didn't expect to ask that question.
Wait, we only have a couple minutes. Can you just do the highlights of them?
Well, okay, real quick. Roger Manning, Sewage, Transgender Jesus, Sexual Suicide, Ruckus Interruptus, Team Spider, and Joe Morella, the guy from Rage Against the Machine.
Oh, wow.
August 3rd, David Peel, Hammer Brain, Porno Dracula, Ism, Bambi Killers, Coffin Daggers, Does the People from Nausea. August 4th, Iconicide, Urban Waste, Nihilistic, Sick Fucks, Antidote, Reagan Youth. The whole point is, Leftover Crack is, I think, out of town that month.
How can they be out of town? Like, Leftover Crack has other
They travel. They across the world. It's weird. They have a worldwide audience. But the point I'm trying to make is we have, like, mostly 80s bands that were there during the riot days. We're trying to recreate that flavor of that time when people were pretty, like, you know, creative. And amazingly, 25 years later, they're still playing. It's fucking amazing. I can't believe it. So we're going to couple that with after-show events, which will be some films at the Morris Museum, which is inside C-Squat, an appropriate location, at 155 Avenue C between 9th and 10th Streets. We'll be starting a film night on August 3rd, August 4th. Films will include Your House is Mine, which documents the squat scene, Tompkinscape Park, Operation Class Warfare, put out by Paper Tiger TV, which gives you a good documentary on from the Tompkinscape riots to the closing of the park in 1992. Other films including ultimately ending the series with Downtown 81 in about, I guess, what is it, 4 weeks of
film? Seven days.
1 week of films at Morris. We're going to have after shows at the Pyramid on Avenue A. We're going to have Norman Siegel and Frank Morales doing a panel discussion at Theater 80 on First Avenue and St. Mark's.
Is there a website where people can find out all the information?
Unfortunately, no website, but...
No website! But there's a Facebook page, right?
There's a Facebook page. As much as I despise Facebook, it's an evil thing. Can someone read the Facebook page, please? I'm sorry.
Oh, we all need glasses here. Give it to me.
It's a dim light in the studio.
Yeah, whatever.
Where's the Braille version?
Look up Times Square Park Riot 25th Anniversary on Facebook. Michael, where can we find you?
Go to Kickstarter and just type in Graffiti Rock.
All right. Well, thank you so much, you guys, for coming.
Tompkins Square Park from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. August 3rd and 4th and July 28th.
I want to put one plug. I have a short story that just came out about 1988 hip-hop. It's called Jaguar and the Jungle Land Boogie, and it's in a book called Black Pulp, put out by Pro C Press.
All right. Well, thank you so much, my substitute, Mike.
Thank you.
All right. See you next week.
Thank you, Judy.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.